Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Fiction. Science fiction. Horror. Fantasy. Crime. LGBT. Thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on Instagram.
106.5
FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 1050 AM Palm Springs.
I'll get you, my pretty, and your little dog too.
Welcome back into the House of Mystery, and I'm Al Warren, sitting at the controls, responsible for everything wrong in the world today. And now today on the East Coast, we have David North Martino, Mrs. Whiskey Martino.
Hey, Al. Mrs. Whiskey.
Yeah, locked in the basement where he belongs.
Absolutely. Chained up in the basement of the House of Mystery.
Igor. Well, actually, it's another dark show. Well, not really. We always have fun with this. But interesting writer we got all the way from the U.K., don't worry, she didn't fly here. Her arms aren't tired. She's on the phone, as we do things nowadays with COVID. And we're going to talk about one of her books, probably both. But I know that A History of the Vampire in Popular Culture, Love at First Bite, great name. And that's Violet Fenn. Thank you for being here.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Wow, and this is by Pen and Sword. We've had a lot of Pen and Sword authors in streaks. On and off, so that's great. That's good publisher, hey?
They're an awesome publisher, yeah. And they're nice because they're fairly small, but they're a very good specialist. You know, they're into their history, they're nice people, and they're happy to take on slightly odd projects, I suppose, compared to some places, yeah.
But I like that. I like the theme of it's not the same old. Like, you look through the titles through Pen and Sword, and there's things like this with Vampire. There's things with, you know, there's books actually that cover a lot of areas that you don't see anywhere else.
Yeah. They've made their name for being a bit of a niche history publisher, and they've been happy to roll with that a bit and not just stick with, because they started with military publishing, and yeah. It would have been easy for them to stick with that, I think, because there's always a steady market for it. You know, people love books about the wars and all this sort of thing. But, yeah, they're brave, and they'll go for slightly off kilter stuff sometimes. That's really cool. But yeah, I mean, I've just finished writing my third book for them, so they must be all right, because I've stayed with them a while now.
Well, yeah, I mean, but I noticed, okay, so now on this newer book, The History of the Vampire Popular Culture, I can't speak today, but the History of Vampires, now that is the number one new release in, you know, Victorian literary on amazon.com, so in the States.
Oh, no, that's amazing, because I did not know that. So,
Just so you know. So that's a really good, it's always a good sign, because then you know that you have a certain amount of people that appreciate what you're doing out the get-go. Like, they're waiting for it, or when they see it, they jump. And that's, you know.
It's one of those subjects that's always been popular, and it's a bit of a frightening move because people love vampires and people are going to have an opinion on it, and you just have to hope that it's 50-50, you know, people who think everything you've said is wrong and they know right, and the other lot will like it, you know.
Yeah.
So it's kind of, you're prepared from the start with a topic like this that, you know, people are going to love it or hate it sort of thing.
Yeah, it's kind of one of those... what do you think that is? Like, I don't know, the world's really changed. In the last 5 years, we've seen some real big changes, and not even just political, but just in the way people adapt to things. Like, you know, so you get the vampire, for instance, they either have one frame of thought and that's it. Like, there's no, people are not as open to really explore other ideas. It's just like it's got to be this and that's it.
I think a lot of that is actually people always did do that. It's just that they didn't have an outlet for making their opinion known, I think. Yeah. Whereas, because if you 5-10 years ago, if you loved a book, you could maybe, if you were really stalkerish, write to the publisher, write to the author, which everyone loves, by the way, you know, write to the authors, tell them they're brilliant, because, or even just say hi, you know, people love this. Any contact is nice. But people didn't have readers or viewers of TV, films and whatever, didn't have an outlet. They could talk to their friends, like, so I love this, but I didn't like that bit or whatever. And I think social media in particular has given people an outlet for every last thought that comes out of their head. And I, most of the time, I love it. I love the fact that people can tell you everything they think about everything, you know, and you can hear it and you can listen. Because I'm good at blocking it out and ignoring bits of it. You know, I'm very good at filtering my Twitter feed, you know, and this sort of thing. But it does mean that if somebody has an opinion, it doesn't have to be a negative opinion, but just a very strong opinion about something you've written, they can tell you, you know, they can post it all over in reviews, or they can say it on Twitter or Facebook or whatever. 99% of the time, I love it. I do like it. People are entitled to their opinion.
Yeah.
But I don't think personally that people have necessarily changed. I think they've just grabbed this outlet for voicing off and they've gone for it because they've not had it before.
Yeah. No, it's crazy. I see all sorts of things, and I'm getting really good at avoiding it now. I mean, but I've been in quite a few of the car crashes online over the years, but it's not so much now. I can let 99. Well,
you get used to working it, don't you? I mean, these days, if something starts kicking off, I'm sitting here thinking, yeah, this ain't my first rodeo. Do you know what I mean? I can just switch it off, cut it down, and we're done, because I know not to keep arguing. But and you learn to filter and whatever, and I'm really lucky that I generally think, in general, online and in real life, most people are nice. They are. Sometimes they get the wrong angle, or they get carried away or whatever, and they think everyone should agree with them. Mostly people are okay.
Yeah, they're certainly better live in that way than they are online, because online I think there's a lot of things going on, and people just it's their vent in a way.
Yeah.
You know.
Totally. And everyone's scared. You know, this last year in particular, people are scared. And if they get through that by yelling on the internet about politics or books or films or whatever, then great. You know, we don't have to listen to it. We can turn it off. And I've seen an awful lot of people get a lot of support from the internet that they wouldn't have had in the real world. You know, some of my dearest now real life friends started off as internet friends, you sort of 15, 20 or more years ago.
Right.
And we've just grown up together through forums and, you know, MSN and MySpace and this sort of thing. So it's a good thing. And yeah, I think a lot of people are, it's their only outlet.
Yeah. Yeah. It's better than a gun.
Absolutely. I mean, and this is the thing, you know, this is the thing, because it's funny she said that, because I live in England, you know, and
right. The
worst we do is somebody shouts, somebody throws things, and that's the end of that, you know. And I sometimes think, God, we think Britain's a bit rough sometimes, but God, it's not. You know, the worst we do is yell at people on the internet most of the time.
Right.
So I really, really, yeah, I shouldn't mind too much about this country.
No, I've been in Canada for over a year now since it started, and God, nothing happens here.
No, I know. We should be grateful for being bored, shouldn't we?
Yeah, you know, if any, yeah, they say, well, Canadians are boring. Well, that's fine.
Yeah, that's good. I'm down with Wolverine.
Yeah, let me, you know, we fight about French. I you know, this is, that's fine. You know, it doesn't get worse than that. I'll tell you. Okay, so now your vampires, now you've written two books, but this, I noticed the vampire book and then the one before you put Sex and Sexuality, Victorian Britain. So I see two things about both books, and one is Victorian era in Britain and also sexuality. So what draws you into those two subjects when you're writing a book like this?
Right. It really ties together in the vampires one, but it's relevant to the Victorians as well. There are only two things in life that affect everybody, whether you like it or not, whatever your religion or non or whatever, and that's sex and death. So, because whether you indulge in it or do it or hate it or whatever, you're a product of sex, even if it was in a test tube, the biological product of it, you know. Right. And everybody dies. Taxes should have been the final one, but obviously, you know, whatever Franklin said, that seems to be optional these days. But so they are the things that affect everybody. And I think they are, mortality and sexuality are very, very closely entwined, you know. Because it's where you're at your most vulnerable in both situations. And I've always been interested in that sort of thing. Before I did what I'm doing now, I ran a website called The Skull Illusion, which collected post-mortem photography. It wasn't mine. It was stuff that I found swimming on the internet and gave it at home. And it ended up being absolutely massive and have tens of thousands of visitors a day. And it was mostly Victorian post-mortem photography, you know, the sort where they would dress them and make them try to prop them up to make them look alive. And that sort of thing, I mean, I realised what a fascination people had with death. And then because I've never had any filters in my life, you know, I would always talk about, you know, sex and things like that. And people could always come to me and ask me questions, I would say. And I ended up quite randomly then out of the blue working for Metro in the UK as a freelance writer. I'd written off and on for years and got a gig freelancing for them. And they rapidly realised that I would cover any topic. And I, you know, I wasn't embarrassed about it. And I mean, they've got daily viewers in the millions. So, and I was the one that was happy to sit there and write about how to make alien sex eggs, you know. So it kind of got like that. And then Metro, I had a wonderful editor at Metro called Yvette Castor. And she asked me if I fancied, she knew my interest and asked me if I fancied doing a series about historical sexuality. So we did that for Metro about 3 or 4 years ago now. And I just sort of became known for writing about sex and death. You know, they are, I say on my website and everything, they're my most passionate subjects. I once got turned down for a job at an undertaker's for being too interested in death. Because they thought I knew too much about it and it was a bit weird. I mean, you'd think knowing a lot about death would be the absolute perfect qualification, but apparently not. I've just sort of run with it ever since. And then the Victorians are an interesting one. It's an era that a lot of people think is prim. You know, they think it's literally buttoned up the Victorians and, oh, they didn't have sex and it was in the dark. And they were not. Whatever era you look at, however far back in history you go in whichever country, people are still doing the same things. The only thing that changes is how much of it they're showing publicly, usually for fear of shame or censure or punishment. So just because you can't see it doesn't mean it's not happening. It's almost certainly happening. So that sort of dichotomy of the primness on the surface and this roiling sort of cesspit sometimes underneath with the Victorians, especially with the contrast between rich and poor, that was just fascinating. And then, of course, the vampires kind of come out of that. I mean, vampires have been my thing all my entire life. You know, I'm 51 now. I grew up watching Universal horror movies, and I grew up with goth music. That's, you know, absolutely my passion. And it just never left. I saw Christopher Lee as Dracula when I was really young, and Bela Lugosi. And I remember watching... I couldn't watch Nosferatu perhaps in my teens or 20s, but it was all the old ones. I love the old monster things. I love the Addams Family, the original, and then the monsters and that sort of thing. So, and you get into modern versions. You know, you look at the Addams Family, but they look Victorian. You know, they look Victorian, even though they're living in the modern day, brightly coloured America. And they've got that same sort of hidden passion. So the two topics are really closely entwined, I think. You know, sex and mortality are at the back of most people's lizard brain, I think, if you dig down.
Are you talking about the Queen?
And look, we don't talk openly about the lizards, but we know. We all know about the lizards. We just don't talk about
them. Well, it's just, you know, it's big rumours here, you know.
I'm unprivileged. It's not even rumours. It's not even rumours. You know, they're just lizards.
They're all real.
Yeah.
I'm waiting for the guillotine, mate. I'm waiting for the guillotine to make a comeback. But, you know, it's parasitic. Don't stop me on the monarchy, honestly. It's parasitic. We shouldn't have it. We're in an era of democracy, and that should be it. So I've got nothing against them personally. Yeah. I genuinely think in some ways they're good for the economy. They're good. They're a good, you know, public view of the country. But they're pointless and they're outdated. Just stop it now. Stop with the Queen. That'll do. Yeah. You know, yeah.
Yeah, you know, there's only one Queen, and that's RuPaul.
Absolutely. You know? If RuPaul can be queen of everything.
Yeah. I mean, you know, at least she works. Boy.
And she looks better.
Yeah.
She puts the hours in. She looks good. She doesn't show her scaly skin in public. We're all right. We're good.
Right. How did the vampire get to what it is? And I mean, when you look at the original Dracula book and idea of Dracula, and now it's turned into this, like you said, it's a real popular culture thing. There's so many movies and shows and everything. So it's fascinating. And then there's even groups out there that think they are vampires and they drink blood and all that.
Yeah.
How did it get so serious where people changed their lifestyles about something that's just really a story?
Well, it started serious because it started based on real things. Dracula obviously was not the first vampire book by a long shot. The first sort of gothic literature would have been The Castle of Otranto by Horace Walpole, which was 1764. That's not a vampire story, but you've got your monster in a crumbling castle and all that sort of thing. So that was kind of the birth of it, and you've got the romantic poets and all this sort of thing. But a lot of the early stories, there are stories of what we would now call vampires throughout history and prehistory and, you know, and all the rest of it. Up until the sort of 17, 1800s, they would more likely have been referred to as revenants, which is literally the undead. And they would have been portrayed as such, you know, as in The Walking Dead. Somebody's climbed out of the grave. They look terrible. They're trying to get revenge on whoever killed them. But though there's an awful lot of folklore about that, King James of England wrote an Encyclopedia of Demonology in the 15 something or other, and that was, you know, that's the king writing about demons, and he was trying to work out, and he'd actually, there's a long piece you can find the whole thing online, there's a long piece where he's trying to figure out how incubus and succubus work and how the demon would take the sperm to the human woman without it getting cold, and basically he has to run really fast. It's not very tough. But the idea behind this has been going for centuries because people are scared of the undead. You know, they're scared of it. Don't forget, for a very long time, you couldn't be entirely sure somebody was dead. You know, to this day, the only 100% definite indication of death is decomposition, because you've got your moral arguments about brain death and, you know, organ death and your heart stopping and your brain stopping. And depending on your religious outlook, those mean different things. So before the days of being able to see what's going on, people weren't that sure. So they were worried about it. And so there's stories of it from centuries and centuries and centuries ago. But you've got the very first sort of vampire, as we would know, it was 1819. And that was John William Polidori, who wrote The Vampire, but with a Y, The Vampire. And based it on a fragment, which was actually just called a fragment by Byron. He was Byron's physician. They ended up falling out and there was all sorts of trouble about it all. But Polidori wrote The Vampire based on a little snippet of a story by Byron. And basically, the main character was based on Byron himself. Wasn't all that flattering. But he was the first person to be your deadly man in a suit and the glamorous and this sort of thing. So that was the start of it. I mean, that's only 200 years ago. So, and then you've got Sheridan Le Fanu, you've got Camilla, who was, basically a lesbian vampire in the 1870s. And then Stoker ran with that in 1897. He really, obviously, is the template now for vampires ever since. You know, they're all really based on Dracula. But it's interesting because we think we know everything from Dracula and we don't really. I was talking to somebody just today about Nosferatu, the film, which was based on Dracula without permission and it should have been destroyed and it wasn't. And that's why we've still got it today, because there was one copy of it kept. Murnau, who filmed and produced Nosferatu, introduced the idea of sunlight killing a vampire in order to change it slightly. He was kind of hoping it would help his copyright argument that it wasn't the same as Dracula. It didn't help his copyright argument. He lost in court. But so they've developed relatively recently. And then I don't know why it is that people have taken it so passionately and run with it. People have got their idea of what they think a vampire does. You know, and if you disagree, then you're wrong and they're right. And vampires do different things. It doesn't matter. You watch a different film, read a different book. They all do different things. You know, I mean, the pinnacle, or actually the nadir of that, is Twilight and the Sparkly Vampires. People think I hate Twilight. I don't hate Twilight. I hate the morals in Twilight. I think Twilight as a thing is an easy watch. It's a fun read. I love it. I've got all the books, all the DVDs, saw all of it in the cinema. Terrible morals. Don't let your teenage daughters watch it, because that is not how to run a relationship. But also, if you were undead, you would not go to school for centuries, would you? You would tell everyone you're 20 and leave. You know, you'd be done. So they're really square. But it just depends. I think, honestly, it depends which one people grew up with, which took a fancy. And everyone wants to be a bit other. Everyone wants to see it be a bit different. And if you're a creature of the night, you can't be more different then, can you? So people want to be different from the norm. And the interesting thing is, and some of my most favourite goths will tell you this, an awful lot of goths and people who like vampires, whatever, are trying so desperately to be different, and they all look like each other. You know, they end up being a crowd anyway. So the ones I like to think I know the better ones, and they don't, they're excellent. But, it's that thing. I think it is just that thing of trying to be other, really, and that idea of immortality and a different life. And, of course, you've always got endless riches. So who wouldn't?
Well, that's what I was going to ask, too, is it this fascination with immortality? Because we even see that with movies like Highlander and stuff like that.
Yeah. And it is. But that's the interesting thing, isn't it? People are fascinated by the idea of immortality and they think they want it. You really wouldn't want immortality. I mean, if you've seen The Hunger, you know, that's basically a vampire movie, but they do not have a happy ending. You know, they just get really, really old and decrepit, and then they lie there mouldering for the rest of time. You know, when she shuts David Bowie away in his coffin to just lie there forever, it's heartbreaking, you know, because he thinks he's got immortality, but what he hasn't got is eternal youth. And that's the difference. And Franz Kafka said, the meaning of life is that it stops. And that, I think, is probably why people get obsessed with vampires, because we have that safety net. We do stop. You know, there's actually me just snagging Twilight, but there's a bit in one of them, I think it might be Breaking Dawn, where she finally, five books in, turned into a vampire, the most tedious vampire ever. But anyway, God, they're boring. But she's turned into a vampire, and I love the line. She says, "I was born to be a vampire," which is a dichotomy if ever I heard one. And also a really terrible career choice. But she ponders this fact that, you know, you're going to be there forever. to the end of time. What happens? Do you just stay there? You watch everyone you know, you love, your children, your grandchildren, their grandchildren, they all die. Yeah, the world goes up in smoke and then reestablishes itself. What? You're just sitting there watching it. It's appalling. People think it's an amazing, it would be an amazing thing, but actually I think it would be the worst thing you could possibly think of.
Well, I guess. Yeah. But now, one thing, though, vampires are very sexual as well. Like, it seems like, other than Dark Shadows, all of the movies and you know, like Interview with the Vampire, Anne Rice and all that stuff, there's a very big sexual element and homosexual erotic as well.
Yeah.
It's a very big element in it. It means a lot. And I wonder why that is.
I think it's because it's physical, isn't it? I mean, a vampire is literally feeding on another person. If you were going down the psychoanalytical route, you know, you've got penetration of fangs in necks, you know. Even in a human setup, if you're with somebody, you know, that you're in an intimate relationship or whatever, you are offering them your neck or, you know, tender bits, aren't you? It's that intimacy and vulnerability, and it's that giving your all to somebody. You know, you're giving your life to somebody, or you're trusting them not to take your life. So and also vampires are hot. You know, they are always hot. There is that element of the minute you are turned into a vampire. I mean, I'm a good few pounds overweight, I'd say. I reckon the minute I turned into a vampire, I'm apparently suddenly 40 pounds lighter, and I've got millions in the bank, and my dress sense is amazing. And, you know, so there is that assumption that you turn into a perfect version of yourself. And you're the hottest thing ever, and everyone adores you, and you can get anything, and you can do anything. Let's face it, you're not going to get cramp, are you, in the middle of sex if you're a vampire? you can just get down and dirty and not worry about it. So I think it's that thing of perfection, isn't it? You know, vampires are seen as perfect, even when they're not. You look at things like True Blood, you know, which are a little bit more raw. I love True Blood because it's a bit rawer. And they are open about what they are, and they're trying to live in reality sort of thing. But they're all gorgeous.
Yeah.
You know, even the ones that supposedly aren't, they're all gorgeous. So, yeah, people see a being a pinnacle of humanity, I suppose.
Yeah, and I find it interesting because I do true crime, and when I know I wrote some cult activity in one book, and there was that... a guy that thought he was a vampire that came back after 400 years, and he had his own group following him, and they were out, you know, killing people. It's really, the mind is so powerful that it can talk itself into such a story, you know?
Yeah. And I mean, that's using the vampire trope as a tool, isn't it?
Right.
That is a cult leader manipulating people. So you get similar with Crowley, Aleister Crowley, and things like that, you know, or Waco, you know, stuff like this. You've got people who whip up the power of crowdthink or whatever to follow them and give them power, and it gives them power over life and death. And I suppose the sort of vampire angle is the most glamorous version of it. It's clearly not true. It's not like, because vampirism, you know, even if it was a real thing, you would be able to see it. You'd be able to, you know, somebody is biting somebody else and they're drinking them.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Blood, and it's making them better. A human, however much they would like to think they're a vampire, they can't do that. You know, they don't have the teeth. Even if they did, you're not... Have you seen where vampire teeth are? In the mouth, always. They're not in the right place.
Yeah.
Like, you wouldn't even get the right place. So... It just doesn't work. So if people are deluded enough to think that... I get the ones that, you know, try to live the vampire lifestyle. It's not my cup of tea at all, but I can see why they might want to do that. If they want to, in a completely consensual relationship, safely drink somebody else's blood, that's up to them and that other person. I've got an absolute rule that as long as it's not, you know, non-consensual harming kids, animals, whatever, then, you know, you don't yuck on someone's yum, as the saying goes. If that's what you want to do, you go and do it. I can't imagine it being very pleasant. Blood clots and it congeals and it's not very nice, but that's just a personal choice, and maybe they feel better for doing it. There are diseases, you know, porphyria can give people vampiric sort of tendencies. It's a disease that is potentially what George III had, you know, the madness of King George and all that sort of thing. But it's never been entirely decided. Porphyria can make people sensitive to sunlight. It can make you allergic to the onion family, alliums and stuff like that, which includes garlic. It can give them a form of pica, which is the desire that pregnant women often get for eating odd things, and that can often include blood, and it's believed to be a lack of iron in the system. So there are medical reasons people might present as that. But as for them going and doing it and following a cult leader, then no, that's down to somebody manipulating them, and it's not to do with them really, that person really thinking they're a vampire, I don't think.
Right, right. They're incubuses and succubuses.
Yeah, you know, if you want an incubus and succubus, I think that sounds like a fun job, actually.
Yeah.
Anyway, I'm gonna see if I can get a transfer to that department.
Yeah. I'm in the ink. Yeah, I'm not touching that one. Not today. Not today. No, it's Friday. Hey, you write this book about the vampires, like, what is it, and I don't mean like got you into it necessarily, but what made you decide to write about vampires in popular culture, and what were you hoping that your readers got from the book?
I did what I think a lot of writers do, and I wrote the book I wanted to read, because what I wanted was a book, and I've got endless books about vampires, but some of them are brilliant. The factual ones are brilliant. You know, there's a book by Nick Green called The Vampire in New History. That's an excellent book. Very factual, straightforward, you know, and also, or you've got your sort of slightly hysterical vampire fiction. I wanted a book that was a fun read. I mean, that's what I do with everything generally. You know, it's what I did with the Victorians. And I've got a book about the Regency coming out next year, and it's the same thing. You know, what I like doing is finding a subject that I love, because I wouldn't write about something I didn't really, really like. There'd be no point. You've got to spend months thinking about it. And I really love it, and it gives me the opportunity to dig into bits of it that maybe I haven't done before, but then I can show it to other people and go, look, this is great. This is why I think this is great. You know, don't you think it's great too, sort of thing. But I can't do it without being quite lighthearted. I like to think I come across being lighthearted and entertaining. Some people might just say I'm trite sometimes, but I can't do anything but write the way I speak. And I think that's just, it's more authentic that way anyway. I'd rather write like that. But I wanted a book that was the book I'd have liked to have read 20 years ago. You know, it's got the basic overview. It had to be a history of the vampire pop culture, not the, because there are millions of versions of vampires just in the last 100, 200 years. Every day I get a message somewhere on social media going, oh, but you didn't include this version that was only released in Patagonia in 1972 or whatever. And I left out Korean vampires entirely, sort of Asian vampires, because to me that's too important a topic. It's a big topic. It's got tied up sort of traditions in itself. Somebody else can do that better than me. And I didn't know enough about it. What I wanted was the vampires that most of us know. You know, the vampires we grew up with, the vampires, because even if you're in your teens or 20s today, you'll have had the opportunity to see the old Draculas or Bram Stoker's Dracula, the Francis Ford Coppola version, which is, you know, by far and away probably the most popular adaptation of it. Most people who have the slightest interest have seen that. And I wanted to write a book for those people, you know, that liked the popular vampires, like the sexy vampires, like the really cool old ones. They weren't too fussed about, we don't have to be precious about this stuff. It's fun. Literature in general, people get so precious and they're like, oh, you did this wrong and you did that wrong. Well, I did my history of it. And if people want to write their own history, brilliant. Go and do it, because it's huge fun, you know. But we've all got different views on everything. You know, everybody could read the same book and you'd come back with a different view on it. So I wanted to write my view. And it is in some places very personally my view, particularly with my opinions on some of the stuff. But I had to cherry pick, you know, and I just thought there's no point. I picked one or two that I didn't like to balance it. But there's no point picking things that I can't be enthusiastic about, even if it's just enthusiastically disgusted at it, you know. I had to have a feeling about it. As far as I'm concerned in life, you've got to do things, feel things, you know, experience things. And I didn't want to write a dry book. So, yeah, I was very lucky in that my publishers did make me rewrite it a little bit and repropose it. It is, you know, and it's for the better for it, because I was originally going to focus on Victorian vampires. And it's better for this because it's things like, you forget how much of popular media affects our views on it as well. There's a fair bit in the book about vampires in the media. There was a big thing in the Gorbals in Glasgow in the 1950s, where children, primary school children, decided that there was a vampire stalking the local graveyard. And the hundreds of children, like primary school age kids, these are sort of like 6 to 10 years old, trawling the graveyard looking for a vampire, and the newspapers came and there was uproar. That led to the 1955 Children and Young Persons Harmful Publications Act in the UK, and there was a similar one in the States, which ended up with certain comics being banned and the introduction of Superman, you know, the good heroes, and as opposed to the slightly scary heroes, you know. And that's from vampire mythology. So it affects our day-to-day life. It is interesting how our lives entwine. And when the world is a scary place, people take refuge in fantasy. You know, so people are interested. And this last year, I'm sure people have read more fiction books in this last year than they have in a very long time. Because what had better to escape than into fantasy? So, I mean, I've gone off topic a little bit there, because I tend to ramble when I start feeling passionate about things. But yeah, I wanted to write the sort of book that I'd have wanted to read, that was interesting, fun, didn't try to trip itself up with being every last single fact about it, because you don't need to know that. You just need to know the basics and have some fun with it.
Is there a difference in the Victorian vampires then as compared to modern day?
Well, like I said, they were, I suppose the Victorian vampires are even more other. Whereas the modern day vampires, especially where you hit your pinnacle with like your Twilight or Laurel K. Hamilton's undead characters, you know, they're in a something approaching our world. You know, True Blood is approaching our world. The Victorian ones with that otherworldliness, or the people who are reading about it wouldn't have been in the world. You know, they were quite often very wealthy in the stories or whatever. And the people buying the penny dreadfuls probably weren't the wealthiest people. They were the ones that were looking for a bit of escape in reading. And the vampires then had the power because of their social status and their perceived position in life, perhaps. Whereas now, and they were noticeably different. Whereas now they have their power in fiction or whatever, because they, you know, can in theory walk amongst us and we wouldn't know. So, and also there's the overhang. It fascinates me that even now you look at something like Twilight, where you've got Edward Cullen, who's supposedly, you know, the perfect gentleman. He's not, but we haven't got enough time to go into that. He's a terribly abusive boyfriend. But he is based on the Victorian hero, isn't he? You know, he speaks properly. She notes how he speaks, that he's from a different time. He is carefully dressed, you know. And Bill Compton in True Blood, he's from the American Civil War, I think it is, off the top of my head. War of Independence, or I can never remember which one it is. And, you know, they're perceived as gentlemen in the old-fashioned style of gentlemen. And if it's women, they're in the old-fashioned femme fatale, almost movie star genre sort of thing. So I was always interested in that hangover for that people have for what they perceive perhaps as better days, which almost certainly weren't. But I do love modern vampires. I absolutely love them. I think the fact that they're still going, you know, is brilliant. But it is notable that it still keeps going back to the originals. I mean, my favourite recent adaptation was the BBC version of Dracula, which came out last year, with Clayce Bang in the lead role. And that really, they did change it, and Mark Gatiss and Stephen Moffat did an amazing job at it. But it's the old Dracula, right, again. Yeah. You know, he ends up in the modern world, but it's the old Dracula. So, yeah, we keep going back. And whether that's because people are scared of going forward, maybe, I don't know.
Well, with going back to folklore, what type of rituals were used to identify a vampire and to dispatch one?
Whether identifying it, people, when you read the old stories, they're pretty obvious, because there'll be tales of somebody prowling around and attacking people. You know, they weren't very subtle. There was quite a lot connected to public health. You've got the New England Vampire Panic, which was Mercy Brown. And the chances are Mercy's family were dying of TB, consumption as it would have been called then. And they believed that the one of the family, usually obviously the last one that survived, would have been sucking the health out of the other ones in order to survive. And they weren't. They were just all getting TB and dying. They would, obviously, you know, they would stake them. That's a common one. They would stake them. They would cut the heads off. Sometimes they would take their insides out. They would disembowel them and bury that elsewhere. Usually chopping a head off, I always say to people, say, well, how do you kill a vampire? Chop the heads off. That kills anybody. You know, it doesn't matter if they're alive or dead. Just chop the head off. It's fine. Or shoot them. Shoot them. If they're at close range, shoot them. Because if you blow somebody's head off, that's it. They're done. So, you know, you don't need to get too hung up on the customs, really. But, they would stake them. And they talked quite a bit about how these bodies from the ground, and there are, Johann Flückinger in Serbia in the 1700s wrote reports for the government about how he'd gone and been involved in digging up and dispatching vampires. And it was reported in the newspapers of the time across Europe and into the States. And he talked of staking them and blood bursting out of them and them making groaning noises and everything. Of course, what people didn't really know then as well is that decomposing bodies can do that. But bodies start getting purge fluid, which is, you know, is basically the decomposition of the insides. So if a body started bloating after death and you stake it, there is going to be awful fluids coming out of it. If it's bloated with gases, it might make a noise because you're forcing air past vocal cords or whatever. So those sort of things probably did happen, but it doesn't mean that people were undead. But yeah, they generally went for staking or beheading, and I would say that's a safe option if you want to get rid of a vampire.
Well, there you go. I didn't know. I didn't know how to get rid of the neighbor. So when you get into the sexuality, I'm fascinated with it. Was there any surprises in Victorian or 19th century sexuality that you didn't expect to find out?
I knew a reasonable bit about Victorian sexuality already because I've been interested in it for years. What surprised me was the scale of it. I knew that, as I said, people were always doing anything you think of, people were doing it. But I didn't realise the scale. I mean, there was, because this is the time, and a part of the reason for all the push for the change in society and everything is we're into the second industrial revolution by this point. So you've got the printing press, you've got newspapers, you've got books, you've got photography started developing, what a ridiculous thing to say. You've got, you know, the beginning of proper camera photography. Of course, the first thing you get books and cameras, the first thing somebody does is make porn, you know. You've got Holywell Street in London, which in the 1800s was described in the Times as the most disgusting street in the Western world or something. And it was a tiny little overhung street in London. It's underneath the Strand now. The Strand was widened into Aldgate and Holywell Street went under. And I'm sure that was done intentionally because it was seen as the worst place to be. But it was basically a street of publishers, and some of them were legit publishers and did your average mainstream books. An awful lot had an upstairs where if you knew and to give the nudge and wink, you could go up and look at the special books. And because written pornography was often seen as an upper class sort of literature at that point, you know, you'd had John Cleland's Fanny Hill in the 1700s. So there was already a tradition of written pornography. And when you've got cameras, it got more so. And then, but what is interesting is that even at that point, there is male homosexuality in the pornography, you know, which was punishable by death up until 1835 in the UK. Well, actually, up until the 1860s, the last hangings for it were, I think, 1835. And but even then, it was already there. It was in photographic form. You had Fanny and Stella, who went on trial. They were two young men who dressed as women. And they did it so successfully that at one occasion, they were in their male suits, and they were arrested for impersonating, for being women impersonating men. So this is how good they were. I mean, RuPaul would have loved them. And they'd have been sitting at the Queen's side. But, you know, but so you had Fanny Stella who were put on trial and subjected to awful physical investigation by a police doctor to figure out the state of their anuses. The records of that are still in Highgate Cemetery offices. For some unknown reason, Highgate have got it. And this is the 1800s. So all this was going on. There's an awful lot of royalty at the time. We're almost certainly gay. You know, some of the princes were definitely up to stuff on the side. You've got poor old Oscar Wilde, who thought, I think, that he was a big enough personality to get away with his behaviour. But he was Bosie. His sort of love was the son of Marcus of Queensbury, who had already lost a son to supposed suicide, or there's talk of it being murder or whatever, having had a relationship with somebody high up. I have to be really careful what I say about some of these situations. And, you know, the tower's still there. Do you know what I mean?
That's right.
But you know, something was going on and it was all coming out. So I think, yeah, I was so interested. And even then, that's not even just the start of it. You know, I'm currently editing a book about Regency scandals, sexist scandals in Regency Britain. And that's not out until next year. But there's a chap in the late 1700s who became known as the London Monster. And he loved to run around poking ladies with pins. And it was clearly a fetish, you know, and it became a sort of almost exciting thing. And if you were pinned by this chap, then you were attractive enough for the monster to want to get you. So there's always fascinating stories. People are interesting. It doesn't matter what century you're in. People are doing fascinating things, usually with each other, when they shouldn't be.
Well, that says it all. So now, where do people find out more about you and find more about your books? Do you have like a website or a...
I do. I have a website. I'm on Twitter and Instagram as @VioletFenn altogether. My website is called sexdeathrockandroll.com with an N in the middle, sexdeathrockandroll.com. My publishers are Pen and Sword, and my books are on there, or you can just search me on Amazon. If you Google me, you'll find the oddest articles I've written all over the years, so please don't hold that against me. I've written some very strange stuff. But Googling me is quite entertaining. But yeah, I'm @VioletFenn on Twitter and Instagram, and my website is sexdeathrockandroll.com, and I love hearing from people, even if it's just a chat.
Okay. Well, we'll have that on our website as well, so that people can find you with one click if they're listening, you know, or awesome. When they listen and stuff like that. So what's next? Anything? What's your next book coming up?
I've got Secrets and Scandals of Regency Britain, Sex, Death and Proxy Rule coming out next year. I'm currently, because I've written historical fact for several years now, and sort of three books have either come out or I've written during a pandemic, and that is enough for anybody. So I am writing fiction at the moment. I'm writing about the undead, obviously, in the modern day in a well-known city in England. So my next plan is to put that out, and because I'm with a history publisher, I don't actually have an agent, so if anyone's listening and wants me, that's great. So I'm looking to get into fiction now, but I'm going to start a podcast. I already do occasional YouTube videos, but yeah, Regency is next, so I'm going even earlier. But that's about as early as I get. I like the close to this point. I go by the close. Yeah. So late 1700s. Before that, the clothes are too big.
Yeah.
Before that.
Yeah.
By the 1780s, you can get through a doorway, and that's my standard in life.
Yeah. You don't want to take 4 hours to get dressed up.
Yeah, it doesn't take as long as you think. That's a myth. Everyone thinks that. No, you can put it all on. Victorian stuff, outfits, whatever. You can get it all on. It's all for yourself. Absolute myth. But that's a subject for another day, because I could go on about that for ages. But there's a lot of layers, but it wasn't difficult to get on because people needed to go to the loo. You forget that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, what does a vampire do during a pandemic?
That's a good question.
I just thought about that.
Stays indoors and eats a lot of chocolate, because apparently that's...
But don't aren't they like turn into bats anyway? So they shouldn't get infected with COVID, right? They should already have it.
Yeah, big up the bats. It's not the bats' fault. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
The bats. You know, and it's not bloodborne. I think the vampires are fine. They're probably having a lovely time because we've all been shut up indoors for 12 months. They can just get on it, pick people up out the windows. You know, it's great. They've had a lovely time. We've been an all-you-can-eat buffet for the last 12 months.
Well, I mean, that's okay anyway, you know. I mean, have at it. Get rid of a few more. It was just too many anyway, you know. Did it affect you, like having the pandemic and having, you know, all this crazy stuff over the last few years? Does that sort of...
Hugely. Yeah. I mean, I have been self-employed for many years and I work from home. However, the overtones of the worry going on. I mean, I've got relatives I haven't been able to see. I've still, at my age, I've still got my grandmother. She's 95. And, wow. And I hadn't seen her. I managed to see her last week and I hadn't seen her for months because of the pandemic, because she's been sort of quarantining. My first book, the Victorians book, was meant to come out the week England first went into lockdown. So that stopped because the publishers couldn't get into their warehouses. So that came out 2 months late. I've had no launches for any of my history books because the social distancing hasn't allowed for it. I finished writing the vampire book in the beginning of lockdown, and I wrote the entirety of the Regency book during lockdown. So I, as I said, I've published or written 3 books since the start of lockdown, and that's been with, you know, my adult but children at home 24/7. I haven't been able to go. There's a library in North Wales. It's the UK's only residential library, called Gladstone's, because it belonged to William Gladstone, the Prime Minister. I used to go there and stay there to write. They've obviously closed down. So I've been sat with children. On my son's partner, who I'd met once before, had come to visit the night before lockdown and ended up with us for 4 months.
Oh boy.
My eldest son's partner. Amazingly, they're still together. They did move, that she did move out and find a house of her own, and now he goes to her. But yeah, she did stay. She was here for months, having met me once. So it was a good job we got on.
Yeah.
I've spent 12 months sitting in my bedroom, surrounded by towering books and writing about vampires and the Regency. So it's been difficult. It's been claustrophobic. Mm. And now I think I've forgotten how to deal with people.
Oh, just call them names, finger them, push them down.
But I did that anyway.
Yeah.
I did
that anyway. Just got to get back into the routine of tripping people, you know. And you know.
I swear, you know, yeah. The first social thing I go out to, I've just agreed to do. I do talks online in person sometimes, but obviously at the moment I'm doing them online for different organisations and whatever, and I've just agreed the first one in person in July, and I'm thinking, oh my God, that's actual people's in front of me, and I don't know what to do. And I'll clearly just forget how to walk across the room or something, you know, it's just mad. I'm not good with people at the best of times, as anyone who knows me in person will tell you. You know, I've got no filters.
Yeah.
But I work on the principle that if people get on with you, then they know you, then it's fine, isn't it? And if they don't tolerate it, then you shouldn't be around them anyway.
Right, right. You know, to hell with them. Wow, it's certainly what a great conversation. We've really enjoyed it.
It's been fun.
Yeah, it's could talk forever. You know, this is nice. And we've learned a lot. My God, you know, Violet has a 95-year-old grandmother who's still alive. She's probably a vampire, that's why. You know, and vampires...
She looks like it. Yeah, she's not got a lot of wrinkles for a 95-year-old.
Oh, yeah, you see, I've heard about these ones. And vampires fart when they're dead.
They can, yeah.
Yeah. See, that
wouldn't have been so glamorous, would it, if Edward Cullen had come out through the window and farted?
I would have liked to see, you know, a Dracula, a big, that would be great. And Violet also likes to read pornography, so there you go. We get it.
I actually used to write it. I had a career as an erotica writer before this one, so... Oh. And I did quite well at it, so I have no shame about that whatsoever. Some of my favourite people write pornography, so I'm big for that. That's good.
Well, you see, we've learned a lot. Well,
yes, we have.
Our guest, Violet Fenn, thank you for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks, Violet.
To find out more about our show, guests, or to listen to past shows from our archive, please go to www.houseofmysteryradio.com.
The mission has been completed.
The end!
By George, he's got it! It is the end!
I'll tell you.
If you're lying to me, I'll be back.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.